Hi, I'm Isaac DeVere, and welcome to Off Message. Our guest today, Sophia Bush, actress and activist. You may know her from One Tree Hill or her current show, Chicago PD. Or you may know her from social media. She's got 1.9 million followers on Twitter and 2.9 million followers on Instagram. That is a lot. We sat down at the Collision Conference in New Orleans, but she talked about some of those crazy on-set stories that she's had, how dealing with some of the sexism she's encountered has challenged her and what she's done to respond to that, both as an activist and as an artist. First, we're going to have a conversation with Carrie Budoff-Brown, my friend, our editor here at Politico, and the host of the Women Rule podcast, which is a great podcast. You should subscribe to it. And of course, you should be subscribing if you haven't already to Off Message. We've got great guests coming up. Rahm Emanuel, Wyclef Jean. Follow me on Facebook and on Twitter at Isaac DeVere. Of course, email me with your thoughts and feedback at Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, at Politico.com. We have a survey so that we can figure out what you want to hear more of, what we can do to get better. It's politico.com/podcast survey. And now our conversation with Carrie Budoff-Brown. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Isaac.
So it was impossible coming through the 2016 election to not be thinking about how women play into politics, right? With Hillary Clinton running and with all this stuff about Trump. In the conversation with Sophia Bush, she talked about how she feels like it's been overlooked that there were all these complaints about Trump, all the sexual harassment complaints. And I think she referred to him, her words were sexual predator in the White House at one point. What is your sense of this moment for how women's issues are playing into politics and shaping things in a way that's maybe different from they were before the election?
I mean, I definitely don't. I mean, I feel like women's issues are coming up because of the absence of the attention to it. Like, you see the photos out of the White House where, you know, there's, I think we notice how when there's just lots of men in photos and there's not many women who are sort of present around the president at this moment in time. And I think that's something that is pretty fascinating to me. And I just wonder what kind of impact that has.
Do we overstate that, you think, that this was the importance of having women around? Obama got into some trouble because it was often pointed out that his favorite people around were white men.
Yeah. Right? I mean, yeah, I pointed this out before. Like, this was, or maybe when I talked to folks that, you know, we forget that Barack Obama had a sort of woman problem at the beginning of his administration. This is a theme of, you know, a sort of recurring theme on my podcast where I talk about this with women. You know, what is the value of having women at the table? What is missing when there aren't women around the table? And I think Barack Obama had to confront this at the beginning of his administration and even in his campaign, because he was much more comfortable, I think, even to this day, being with like the bros and talking about sports and all the stuff. Not that women can't do all that, but it does. I have talked about how even as a reporter covering Barack Obama, that it was sometimes like I didn't quite feel like I fit in because I wasn't towel snapping and talking about the Nats.
Well, if you're
all
not
the time.
Like a frat boy with the Obama people.
And I was not a frat boy. So it was sometimes like there was a distance. But so I think the argument or what we hear is that each president, when they come in, you know, they gravitate towards the people who have always supported them. These are obviously all presidents have been men, and, you know, they gravitate towards what they know. And but now it's like incumbent upon them, now that they're in office, to figure out how to have some balance around the table. And I think this is going to be a recurring theme of this White House, given that we don't really have a lot of women around him right now. Is Kellyanne Conway, there's Sarah Sanders, of course, who's on the podium sometimes. Ivanka, naturally, like, by all accounts, his most trusted advisor, and she's the one who is whispering in his ear talking about these women's issues.
And yet she's the one who, she says she wants to talk about these things, and yet so many women are suspicious of her, Democratic women at least.
And that's also like another theme is just when I talk to Democratic women, given that Ivanka is clearly trying to build alliances in this town, but she has a Democratic women, as you hear and I've heard talking to people, there is this resistance to her to not sort of provide cover, in their view, to to Ivanka that, and they're trying to, I mean, they're, I think they're all trying to feel out the tactics, because on one level, I think a lot of women, Tina Chen, others, you know, Ivanka is working on issues that do matter to them. And so it's a struggle for them to be like, well, I really want to see her do well, but like, I really want to show through however I respond to her inquiries, like, I want to show that she's got to stand up and be more strongly forceful to the president for women's issues. So it's a real struggle, I think, a lot of the progressive women infrastructure in Washington that they're dealing with.
A lot of what Sophia Bush and I talked about was experiences that she had feeling just intense sexism on set, on shows, these stories about men trying to shut her down or making lewd comments to her. How much of that is a factor in Washington reporting and things that you've sort of seen, had to deal with over the course of this?
You know, my experience is it's more like the decisions I've made to avoid situations like that. You know, I always, when I'm meeting sources, when I was reporting full time, is that I would only meet men probably for coffee or lunch. I rarely did like alone dinners with men, and I'm not like Mike Pence where I wouldn't be, you know, don't think I could go out with a man. But there are certain boundaries that are certain
because
sort of rules.
You didn't think that they would be able to handle it.
No, I think people could handle it. It's more just like a comfort. Like, how do you navigate this world? Honestly, that was probably, I don't know if it was ever conscious, but it was just, it always felt more natural for me as a woman to be like, let's grab coffee, let's grab lunch. And I would tend to grab dinner with my female sources. And it was just my own thing. It wasn't really based on anything other than like my own comfort level, but it's also, you're conscious of like the dynamics of being a woman, a female reporter in Washington. And for me, it's, I feel because I was a woman covering the White House, that there is this great network of women in Washington covering the Hill or covering the White House. And I've gained like such like sort of a sister. There's like a sisterhood here that I've developed through various means, whether it's through like a charity softball game or women's dinners, female reporters in the White House all banded together. When we covered the White House together, I could sometimes sense you're a little jealous of my women's dinners.
There were dinners that the women, that female reporters got together and had with a lot of senior people in the White House that men were not invited to.
Men were not invited.
And that sometimes did put me at a disadvantage in the reporting, which is funny because like the whole thing was
because we felt we needed some advantages, and that is for listeners, we used to, there's a strong
and they were
network
often of, at really nice restaurants too.
So it was, you know. So there's like a strong network of women who got together and we had dinners, and we would invite members of the administration, Lisa Monaco, you know, Valerie Jarrett, any number of folks in the Obama administration, and then we would have these dinners with them and we would get to know them, and that was our way of making connections. And we felt like it was our way, if we all got together and banded together, there would be a critical mass and we would get the attention of people in power.
And you did.
And we did. It wasn't just women we took out, of course.
Sure.
There was lots of men who were our guests, and yeah, I feel like I benefited from it in a way that you did not.
I did not.
So I had the power and you did not. And the same thing repeats itself on the Hill. I think in actuality, like it's a lovely thing when you feel like you have, you know, sort of support, even though they're competitors.
Is this you got to Washington reporting about 10 years ago, right? Reporting before that in Philadelphia. Do you feel like this has gotten better, this situation? Has it evolved at all? Or are we still in the same place?
I mean, I speak from an experience where I don't feel like I was ever at a disadvantage because of my gender, really.
That politicians deal with this stuff.
I think there's far more awareness of like what you can say and do, and you know, the respect that you command, and that you're not a honey or a babe or anything like that. I think that was far more prevalent 10, 15 years ago when I was covering state politics in Pennsylvania and Harrisburg and Philadelphia than it is here. Though I know for a fact that a lot of my female colleagues, you know, in Washington have lots and lots of fascinating stories about what it's like to be a woman and not feel like you're at the same level sometimes, or that you're sort of still stuck in the old paradigm of like, you know, power men thinking what they can do and say and treat you. But I, you know, I've been pretty lucky where I haven't had quite that many.
You talk to a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats for women's role. Do you feel like there's a different view among the guests that you've had on these issues, on whether they think the problem is as large or as needing of a solution?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's remarkable similarity between the Republican women I've interviewed and the Democratic women. Remarkable sort of candor about the challenges they face, the barriers, how they have to work harder. They feel like there's just a lot of commonality there, and a lot of commonality in sort of pinpointing the reasons why women still are only, 20% of Congress, and, feel like, they're just judged by different standards. So there's a lot of commonality between the two parties on this stuff.
All right, Carrie.
The solutions are not, they don't always have the same solutions, but they often identify the same problem.
Well, that's why you got to tune into Women Rule
exactly.
To hear what they have to say about it. Carrie Budoff-Brown is the host of Women Rule. Subscribe to that podcast. You can find it on iTunes and on our site. And now coming up, our conversation with Sophia Bush. So let's start with this. You were politically active before the election.
Yeah.
But
always.
So how does the election, how does what happened in November change the way you think about your role, what you want to be doing, the kind of activism you want to be doing, and about where politics is at this moment?
Well, I think what's been a really just interesting falling out is that the politics of this election itself have really unearthed a lot of things that have been in the works for years and that have been very sort of paper bag, bottom shelf, all of the gerrymandering, mm-hmm. all of the sort of closed door movement in government that was really setting up a domino effect to reduce democracy. And I think now everyone is seeing it. And it's deeply unfortunate that now people are going, oh, wait, because it's too late.
Was it stuff that you were aware of before?
Certainly. You know, there are things that I think are unavoidable if you're politically engaged or concerned with current events in any way. But there's things that I think are sort of hitting a national stage now in a way that are unignorable for people. And look, there are very big industries that make lots of money behind the scenes when people are not engaged. You know, it's my friends and I have been calling it the Wally effect. It's like they want to keep you grossly unhealthy and distracted so that you're not paying attention to the wresting of control. It's very scary to see where we are, but more people than ever understand the manipulation of the Koch brothers behind the scenes. More people than ever in years since it all happened are aware that it was Republicans who voted to reduce security at embassies leading up to Benghazi. You know, there are things that people just weren't talking about. And everything has become, you know, a tweet or a quick headline, and nobody really reads the article. So what's been interesting for me is I definitely see more and more people fully reading the articles that I find important to share, and more people who say, okay, we were sort of disillusioned with government, and we really thought that there was nothing the average person could do, but this is like extraordinary. Nobody ever predicted this. Nobody ever thought that this could happen. You know, there are people obviously who were
not
warning
many.
Us for long.
Well, I mean, but you know, Donald Trump and a lot of people who worked on his campaign like to say that they knew that this was coming, but they didn't. They were they were surprised.
I mean, he has no positions filled in the White House still because he never thought he would get there.
But in terms of your own activism, the mm-hmm. way that you approach it, how has it gotten more real for you, I guess, too, right?
The stakes feel higher, but it hasn't changed my voice. Mm-hmm. If anything, I'm even less worried, which a lot of people think is strange. They say, you know, you're a public person and your job depends on who watches your show and, you know, you don't want to offend anyone. And I'm I'm a person first. Mm-hmm. My job is my job. It's not who I am. You know, if I were a banker, I wouldn't be silent on issues that matter to me because, like, what if somebody doesn't come to my bank? You know, if you really hate my opinion about wanting the environment to stay clean, wanting rivers to stay free of toxic coal waste, wanting children to have heart surgery if they need it, bro, don't watch my show. Like, I don't care. Honestly, I just don't care. It's like, it's not rocket science. I believe in the importance of storytelling. I believe in the importance of art. I believe that human beings, since we evolved, you know, early days of the human, we would get around a fire in our village and we would tell stories. Our history as people was all oral tradition. That was all performance. You know, you look at the lasting impact of the Shakespeares of the world. And I mean, look, I'm not Shakespeare. I'm not even a writer. But I believe that we create empathy and that we can offer perspective in my industry. So I really do think it's important. But I'm also not curing cancer. If my opinions as a person who has just as much right to her First Amendment as you make you hate what I do for a living, like, okay, I don't have to agree with you on anything. But you know, a lot of the Trump voters who would really like come at me and attack me during the election and even since, I just always say, I go, wow, yeah, I'm a terrible person. I voted for the person who would increase my taxes so that I could make sure that your kids could have lunch at school and go to the doctor.
Do you get that hate on Twitter? I mean, that's I mean, you, a lot of what, not oh, certainly yeah, no. not all of what you do, but people a lot are... of what you do is your big presence on social media, mm-hmm. right? I looked at it, 2.9 million on Instagram, mm-hmm. 1.9 on Twitter. That's not bad. first question is, how much are you thinking about how you put yourself out there that way? Or is it just really like in the moment?
It's not a strategy.
Yeah.
It's, I have a feeling and I talk about it. It's the same as, you know, if I'm having dinner with friends and some insane thing has happened in the political arena that day and I come into dinner and I'm like, can you fucking believe this? It's like, it's literally the same. I'm screaming on the internet and I'm screaming it at home. And I'm also like sharing things that I find inspiring and beautiful. And I tell you something that's changed for me. I grew up in California. I love nature. Nature is like, that's my church. Take me to a mountain. That is my church. And I'm doing like really a lot of flower workshops lately. There's a really cool company.
What's a flower workshop?
So there's a florist in Chicago that I found. They're called Flowers for Dreams. And I found them because a friend sent me a bouquet and was like, this is right up your little world-saving alley. These people donate a quarter of their profits to Chicago charities. And there's like a ticker and you can see, and they're up. A couple weeks ago, they were at like $195,000 donated. They're amazing. And they have like no footprint and they're super environmental. She was like, literally, this is your dream. And I met the guys. I went in there because I was getting flowers for people. And they do these workshops where literally you go in and you make bouquets and you learn how to make wreaths. And you do. I'm doing a lot of that because it's literally something that is making me feel more sane, touching nature, appreciating beauty. People on Instagram have been like, wow, you've really been storying a lot of florists lately. And I'm like, oh, I'm just surviving. This is me surviving in a world in which, you know, 24 million Americans are losing their healthcare. So it's not a strategy for me. And I'm sure there are people who would tell me that it should be, but I also just don't care. Like, I'm not a robot. I'm not a brand. I'm a person. And I perform and I speak and I tell stories and I want to connect people and make people feel feelings. And that's kind of it. It's like, it's just not that fancy. I'm not that fancy.
But you do. I mean, one of the true things about Twitter is that it's full of a lot of people who will come at you with their opinions. A lot of them filled with a lot of hate. Mm-hmm. You must get a lot of that. Like, how does that... What's the response to that? What do you do? I mean, it's got to hit home with you at some point, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are things that will keep you up at night. And I don't
like
mean
what?
Like for a day. I mean, for days. I mean,
like threats?
I have. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And also just the way people speak to each other. I'm astonished at the cruelty and the judgment and the sexism and the ease of threat and the ease with which people will detail ways in which either you should kill yourself or they'd like to kill you. It's so shocking. Truthfully, the intensity of it, and I choose to remain an optimistic person. I really try my best, even though I'm fired up about a lot. But my social anxiety is through the roof. I've become increasingly agoraphobic. I don't like being in public spaces anymore. It's really...
Because you feel frightened?
Absolutely. Yeah. And also commodified in a way that mm-hmm. has increased. Like, people will stick phones in your face. They take your picture when it's so clearly inappropriate. Like, I caught someone Snapchatting me at the gym 2 days ago. And I was doing squats. And I was like, do you not understand that I'm in a private gym where I pay to be here with a trainer, and you are recording imagery of my body this is so deeply inappropriate. And that's not a person who's threatening me.
Right. Nobody wants pictures
of them
doing
squats. But what happens when that goes on the internet is it then gets used by other people. And that's sort of a supply chain that I think a lot of people are blissfully unaware of, but I unfortunately am not. The thing that I've done that helps, I have two photo streams on my phone. One is actual illegal violent threat harassment screen grabs. Mm-hmm. Because now people know that they can come in and create an account and then delete it and then create another one. And so I keep records literally of everything.
You send them to law enforcement?
I have three police officers on it, three lawyers on it, an agent from, you know, mm-hmm. my team on it. And I mean, people that I show this stuff to burst into tears. People literally go, I don't understand how you do this. I don't understand how you haven't moved to Montana. You deal with this every day. And that's just real threat. Then there's also just the revolting underbelly of, like, astonishingly cruel, rude, divisive, disgusting, repugnant society that feels empowered because they sit behind a computer. So I'm like, okay, these are prosecutable offenses. These are just so shocking that I feel like there should be a record of this shit. And there's thousands of photos in each one.
Yeah.
I only started keeping them like this about a year and a half ago. And it's when people experience it with you that they suddenly go, oh, I had no idea. You know, when friends spend 3 days off in the city with me and they go, oh, I had no idea what it was like for you. I'm having an anxiety attack. Can we not go out to dinner? Because I don't want to deal with it. And there's a lot of people who go, oh, yeah, I feel so bad for you. And then they spend time with you and they go, oh, actually, this is really hard. Yeah. It's really hard to never be able to feel unscrutinized. And it's strange because then there's critics who say, you signed up for this.
Right. And you're tweeting and you're, you know,
sure,
you're bringing it.
But
right?
I didn't.
Like, there's that argument. Wow. Yeah. You're bringing it on yourself. But, like, it's a weird thing where, like, that to express your political opinion means that you need to just get used to it.
Well, means that you need to be threatened with rape and maiming.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting thing. And, you know, I didn't, quote, sign up for this. I became an actor when there was no such thing as social media. I do think it's incredibly important. I think especially because of the amount of nonsense on it, people who have, you know, values and who are champions for equality need to be speaking up about why that's important.
Yeah.
You know, you need smart, educated voices on those platforms. But it is interesting to hear from so many, you know, smart, educated people that they really struggle to survive the viciousness of that sea that mm-hmm. they're rowing their little boats in. It's tough.
This is a moment where women's activism has been sort of front and center, right? Mm-hmm. The Women's March was right after the inauguration, or the Women's Marches, right?
Yeah.
You were in D.C. for that?
Mm-hmm.
I was at that one. And a question that I have had, and I've asked some people about, and I'm curious what your take is. Do you think if Hillary Clinton had won, she would have been the first female president, right? It's mm-hmm. a big deal for women.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there is a possibility that the amount of energy around women's activism is actually larger now because of what it's reacting to mm-hmm. than if it had been what would have been a breakthrough moment for women in politics. Do you, I mean, where's your
Sure. I mean, look, that's the silver lining that I try to offer up to people all the time. I go, well, at least what's happening now that we're in an absolute garbage dumpster fire is that people are fired up. I think that that's the optimistic nature of, you know, the human soul is
Do you
to
think
say,
it's true?
Certainly, I think it's true that so many people are up out of their seats.
But like more than if she had won.
Was it more important? Because if Hillary had won, we wouldn't be dealing with an administration that would call sexual assault a pre-existing condition. We wouldn't be dealing with an administration that's attempting to take maternal care out of insurance. I want to walk into Congress and raise my hand and go, hey, bros, if I'm expected to pay into your Viagra, you sure as shit are going to pay into my mammograms. What is happening? This is insane. This is insane what we're seeing. And some of that insanity wouldn't be happening. Would we still be dealing with very shady local governments gerrymandering their districts and rolling back the VRA? Absolutely, which is also completely unacceptable. But we wouldn't be giving coal plants permission to dump toxic waste in the river. That just wouldn't be happening.
And there's a different conversation around feminism that's going on now. This is an important issue to you, right?
Right, because we have a sexual predator in the Oval Office. This is a man who has sexually assaulted women. How many women have to come and talk about it before they believe them? It's like Bill Cosby all over again. But guess what? Bill Cosby is like a retired TV star. He's not the fucking president of the United States. And the fact that people go, oh, well, you know, those women made it up. Like, I have women defending Bill O'Reilly to me. And I'm like, are you kidding? Are you kidding? I work in TV. I'm very aware of what the climate is for women. Yeah. Bill O'Reilly is guilty. I know people who work at that network. I know people who work on his show. Everybody knows. And everybody knows what Donald Trump is.
Cosby, the question, it became like, well, 10 women, are they all saying? But then yeah, it's like 50 women, well, like probably.
Probably, yeah, like how many women? And why is one woman not enough?
Right.
Why is that not enough? And it's so shocking to me. And like there's this attitude of like, yeah, well, you know, if you guys weren't so pretty, excuse me? Like, do you know how many hot guys there are at award shows in Hollywood? Have I ever grabbed one of their asses? Never. Come on. You know, it's an astonishing pile of dung we've stepped in here.
You talked about it when you were talking about feminism at the conference, and talking about being on TV and how you fit into the on set, and that you have a right to take up space. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I have a right to have my opinion as a creative, as an actor who's done nearly 300 episodes of serialized drama. Which is many more than many of the people I'm surrounded with every day, be they directors or other actors and actors who are twice my age. I have a right to have my opinions be listened to without being interrupted. I have a right to come into set and have someone not make a remark about how my jeans fit. I have a right to exist in my world without feeling threatened or written off. Or when I make a suggestion, have someone roll their eyes, or
feel
like I. There
was a story you told about somebody putting a finger in your face.
His
right?
full hand.
So can you just say what
yes,
is that?
Yes, I had a. There was a scene that we were breaking down, and we had this wonderful director on set named John, but it was John's first episode ever directing our show. So he was being steamrolled a little bit by someone, and there was. Feedback given, which I actually agreed with, that the scene was improperly written for the amount of urgency that it needed. But it was 9 o'clock in the morning in central United States time, and our writers on the West Coast are clearly not in the office at 7 a.m. They're home, like, getting their kids up and ready for school. So we're not calling a writer and either waking them up or interrupting their morning, nor would they be allowed to, or able to, rather, redraft something and get it to us in the next 8 minutes. And time is very precious on a show like ours, where you're doing 10 pages a day. So this argument was sort of going back and forth, and it was really hemming on how it wasn't written right. And I'm sitting there thinking, as a director, also as a member of the DGA. Like, yeah, well, you bring this up before you come to set. And I went over and I said, excuse me, John, I have an idea. And this actor reached his outstretched arm up with his palm spread, fingers 2 inches from my nose, put his whole hand across my face and gestured forward and went, stop. And I inhaled, about to say something, and he goes, no, stop. And put his hand down and turned back to the director. And I took a deep breath because I went, okay, this is where my irrational rage kicks in. And I want to hurt.
Well, somewhat rational rage.
I mean, rational, but like, I knew that if in that moment I said something, I wouldn't be collected. And this, again, is the difference. As a woman, rather than, if that had happened to a man, he would have been able to be like, fuck you, you know, and they could have had a fight. But if I start yelling, it's, oh, you're so sensitive. Oh, you're so emotional. And so I took a deep breath. And I took a few steps back. And I turned around to the room and I said, I'm just going to clarify right now. If anybody ever puts a finger in my fucking face like that again, I'm going to break your hand. And he stopped and looked at me. And the director stopped and looked at me. And there was a pause. And I went, my suggestion was the following. And I broke down how, with certain technique of emphasis, energy, mm-hmm. someone sort of coming into the room very emphatically on one line, we could change the tenor of the scene without actually changing the words. And then if a beat was given after these 3 lines that didn't really work, but we could make them work, if there was sort of a, you know, beat, beat moment, and then the team jumped into action, that we would get the urgency that we needed. And the director was like, I actually think that would work great. And this actor, having now feeling humiliated rather than just owning that he was an asshole, sort of looked at me very begrudgingly and was like, well, I guess we could, you know, he was like, I guess we could try it. And it worked great.
And how's your relationship with that actor since?
He doesn't adore me. Because I don't go, oh, hi, it's so nice to see you. How are you? You look handsome. Men on sets, especially in the arena that he exists in, sort of want you to flirt with them. They want young, pretty girls to kowtow to them a little bit and be like, oh, mister, thank you so much for my job. And guess what, asshole? I'm not going to do that for you. I have a right to take up space because I am a talented performer who was hired to do my job just like you. And if you want to compare resumes with me, we can do that. But that will further make you feel emasculated in the way that my not flirting with you does. But your feelings of emasculation because I don't stroke your male ego are not my problem. And that's the kind of space I am allowed to take up. I am allowed to just exist as a person who does not exist for your pleasure, your entertainment, or your projection. That's not my job. And it is very hard. It's a harder tack to take to just get through the day. And I think that's why a lot of women laugh at jokes that aren't funny. And a lot of women say, oh, Mr. Whoever, you look great in that suit or whatever, because it greases their day. And there's data behind this. This isn't my perception. This isn't a sort of negotiable fact. This is a fact. There is a fact that when at a company recently, they had a male employee and a female employee switch email accounts for 1 week. Her performance shot through the roof. The response times when she would send an email out to getting one back were cut by 60%. I mean, her entire world changed. She didn't use any different language. She didn't make any different proposals, but she signed off as a man. And everything was different. And this is something you can look at on a graph. But there's so many men who don't want to believe it, maybe because they're good guys, or who feel threatened by it because they think, oh, well, if it's not equal now, but you're here, then when it's equal, will I not have a job? No, of course you'll have a job. It just won't be so irritating for me to do my job. I won't feel like I have to put armor on to come to work every day. You know, it's not appropriate. I had a guest star recently who was old enough to be my father when hearing about my activism and also my involvement in the tech community, started asking me about how I got started investing and what kinds of companies I believe in and what sorts of causes I'm into and, you know, how do you talk about it? And I talked about how social media is so wonderful for that. that I can spend a month in Uganda and take millions of people on this trip with me and educate them about women's issues there and about gender parity and what the Millennium Development Goals, how they'll shift. If we just create parity, we solve 50% of them like that. And also how it's not just a moral imperative because women deserve to be treated equally and deserve not to be killed simply because of their sex, but if we actually created global gender parity, we would on average raise the GDP of countries by 12%. This is also fiscally responsible.
So what's the reaction from the guests around
that? And then it's like, oh, wow, you know, that's so cool. And, I'm older. I don't use Facebook. He goes, I don't use social media. You know, I don't know. And one of our camera guys goes, yeah, man, but come on. Like, you're a dad. Like, even my dad's on Facebook. Like, you probably, like, keep people up to date with pictures of your kid and stuff, right? And he doesn't break stride. He's looking at the cameraman and he says, yeah, I don't really use Facebook. And he comes across the table, makes eye contact with me and says, but I'm a big fan of Sit on My Facebook.
And what is the response to that?
It's like my whole body went numb and I was instantly sweating because I was so angry and shocked. And I was so let down because this was someone who'd spent 4 days on our set, who I'd had all these conversations with about environmental rights and clean water and like cool, you know, plants from the rainforest that are curing cancer. Like someone who I think is an evolved person. And what I wanted to say, and probably what I should have said truly, was, I'm sorry, did you just make a joke in my place of work in which you are a guest that I should put my genitals on your face? But I looked at him and I went, that's not cute. And he made the joke again, thinking I didn't get it. And also,
it's not that complex of a joke.
I have to be sensitive to what's happening in the room because there's 200 people gearing up to shoot a show. And the real kicker to this is that we're shooting my coverage. It's my close-up we're about to shoot. And I have a 2-page monologue. I have to be totally focused. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me right now. And so he does it again, and I said, you know what? We'll talk about that later, but I really don't appreciate the humor right before my close-up. And he went, oh, I'm so sorry. Let's get serious. Do you want to run it? And he was like back into – and I went, wow, so you're more sensitive to my needs as a performer saying pretend words than you are to the fact that you just talked to me about my vagina in a room full of 50 people. Sitting next to other men your age in front of a group of men who are my crew, many of whom came up to me after the scene and were like, I want to beat that guy's ass. Like, I wanted to punch him in the face. And I understand why they didn't, because they would get fired. Because sexual harassment is pretty tolerated, but physical assault in the defense of a woman never would be. Chew on that one. And it's all the time. And I know that I'm a very strong, outspoken, clearly like not to be messed with woman. So I go, if that's how I get treated, if this is how people talk to me, and like, let me tell you what, in an environment like a show where there's a lot of egos going around and like it's kind of a big swinging dick competition all the time. Like I walk in there and I'll win. Like I'm like, bro, I can win a big swinging dick competition with all of you any day. Like I'm not a person who walks onto set like a flowery, vulnerable, you know, woodland creature.
Despite your flower
and
making.
Yeah, well, listen, but that's on my personal time. I'm at the florist on my personal time. That's a good thing. In my business, we call that the long callback, and that's like a really desirable comedic skill, so touche. Like you do that on a talk show, and like Jimmy Fallon will lose his mind. But so I really think about like what happens to the girls who were 22 and really friendly because they're scared on a set. What happens?
You play a police officer in Chicago. We had a conversation the other day with Rahm Emanuel, who's the actual mayor of Chicago. Mm-hmm. I wonder what playing a police officer, thinking about things from that, you've done, you've had encounters with actual police and doing this.
Yeah.
How that's changed the way you think about how all the pieces of a city come together, our society come together. I take it Rahm Emanuel is not visiting the set on a regular basis.
But. You know, it's interesting. I mean, listen, we're we are theatrical at the end of the day. We're telling stories. A lot of the stories that we tell do come from our technical advisors. And these are stories from real police. And there's a reason that when the audience watches a cop show, they love those cops and they feel like they're heroes, because they are. They are such good people. There are also cops that have insane amounts of CRs on record that are wildly I don't even know what the word I'm looking for is. Like, there are people who wear a badge who it's just categorically inappropriate for them to be in a position of power, no question. But I also look at it in the way that I would look at any large company. Not every employee at a cool company or an important company is a nice guy. There's no way that if you worked in an office building with 13,000 people, there wouldn't be some royal assholes. And there wouldn't be people in that building who'd sexually assaulted someone. And there wouldn't be people in that building who, you know, were serial adulterers, like whatever the thing is. So just as a statistical reality,
sure,
of course there is a problem.
And
but if I may, the reason that it's so, I think, serious, and that I'm so glad that videos are being made public and these conversations are being had more publicly and people are getting really active who might have been a little scared even a year ago, you know, to say something, is because that's a statistical problem that has a gun, and that because of having a badge has a fair amount of sort of immunity, or at least the general perception of sort of guilt versus responsibility tends to skew responsibility towards the cops. But on top of that, and I get criticized when I say it's an absolute assault on democracy that, you know, a boy with a BB gun gets murdered by the police in a park. He was murdered. That's not an accidental shooting. That kid was murdered. And if you look at the video, and this is what I do now, is I sit with my technical advisor every single time one of these cases happens. And I go, tell me what you think. Watch this video with me and tell me what you think. And he's like, that was wrong. What you're supposed to do, before that little boy, before Tamir Rice was shot, that cop should have gotten out of the car. He should have given these three verbal commands. He should have been behind his door. He should have taken cover here. They'll walk me through all of the steps that a police officer is supposed to take before shooting someone. And what's been the most interesting to me is, obviously, aside from families who've lost children or husbands or brothers or fathers, the people who are the most deeply upset and affected by improper police violence are the cops that I work with every day.
Does it, Chicago has a problem with crime at this moment?
Yes.
Not, it's Chicago PD, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. If you were doing Miami PD or whatever,
sure,
it might be different. Does that make it even more heightened, do you think, that there is this much attention to what's going on with the police in Chicago?
Yes, I think so, but I think that we're still only looking... It's a bit like medicine. It's like looking at the symptoms and not really looking at the root cause. The reason that Chicago has such an insane crime rate is because of poverty and because of racial inequality and because of virtual segregation and because of not just food deserts, but opportunity deserts. If you have a choice between feeding your baby by selling heroin or watching your kid die, what are you going to do? And that's a really interesting thing and sort of problem if we look at it like from that perspective of data. If we look at it like an equation, I like to look at those problems with my technical advisor. I go, okay, so I've been on raids with you on the far west side and we've arrested heroin dealers. And, you know, like I've walked into houses wearing an actual bulletproof vest and like being told like, hey, keep your head down. Like you don't know what's going to happen. These guys are risking their lives. They also kind of feel like rats on a hamster wheel because they're like, yeah, we're arresting all these people, but like we're not stopping it from coming in. We're getting it off the streets, but it's still coming here. How do you cut the head off the hydra? And how do you then on the other side start supporting communities with programming that eradicates the need for the hydra in the first place?
Yeah.
Those are the problems that I would like to be solving, and I'd like to hear Rahm's perspective on those things.
He has, he's working on some of it, he says, but there's obviously a lot to do, a big problem.
we talked about how your the activism and your acting have come together to date. I wonder, as a sort of a last question here, you care about a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. Do you think it will change the choices that you're making in terms of your acting career, into things that you want to be doing, projects that you want to be working on? Does it influence, especially given what's going on in this larger moment for American politics?
You know, it's tricky. Every choice, every sort of goal you set in my experience is really case by case. You know, I read every script and I either light up at it or I go, I don't want to do this. There are risks I want to take in my career that I haven't taken yet that I'm looking forward to. Whether those will go over well with people or not, I have no idea, nor can that really be my priority. You know, I am learning to just take up my own space. I am learning to say something when someone puts a hand in my face or says something inappropriate on a set before my close-up. I had a long conversation with him after he wrapped. Mm-hmm. I was like, I gave you the space and courtesy to not pull you aside and tell you what I thought before we turned around on the scene. I waited two more days until this gentleman was done working on our episode because I know how intimidating it would feel to suddenly know that 200 people on a crew think you're an asshole because you just sexually harassed a woman at work. I know that it wasn't done because he meant to be inappropriate. He thought he was being funny. But I also made sure to sit down and very clearly say something and stand up for myself and for every other woman who he ever encounters in the future on a set, whether it's her set or whether she's the guest star. I think that for me, it's evolutionary. And as I'm evolving as a person, yes, I'm taking in everything happening in the world. And so there's a very good chance that I'll be fighting for the roles in films that really have to do with political subject matter more than I might fight for the role in a great comedy. But you know what? It also could be like a flower workshop. The truth could be that at the end of a season of telling stories about murder and crime and assault and drug dealers, like I might just really need to go do a comedy. I might need to laugh so that I don't cry. And I might also really be excited to make other people laugh because everyone like really feels like they're going to cry all the time right now. Every time I get a news alert on my phone, I'm like, not again. So, you know, it's amorphous. It's evolving in the moment. But certainly knowing what I know, having had the experiences that I in my life and body have had, I'm informed by those things.
All right. Sophia Bush, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.